This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Ukrainian president says Russian forces destroyed critical infrastructure in Kherson before fleeing, adding that local authorities are working now to stabilize the city. Thousands of anti-government demonstrators in Albania gathered just outside the prime minister's office in the capital, Tirana, to protest the cost of living crisis. And Iranian and Russian presidents seek to deepen political, trade, and economic cooperation. Hello, everyone, and a very warm welcome to World News. In our top story, the Ukrainian president says Russian forces destroyed critical infrastructure in the southern city of Kherson before pulling out their forces from the area.
As of this evening, the defense forces have established control in more than 60 settlements of Kherson region. The police have also started stabilization measures. Stabilization measures are also ongoing in Kherson. Our explosive experts have a lot of work everywhere in the free territory. Almost 2,000 explosive items have already been removed. Mines, tripwires, unexploded ammunition. Before fleeing from Kherson, the occupiers destroyed all critical infrastructure, communications, supply, water, heat, and electricity.
Zelensky said that extremely fierce fighting is now going on in the Donetsk region in the east of Ukraine. The Russian military ordered a pullout of Kherson Thursday. The Russian commander in Ukraine said it's no longer possible to keep supplying the city. And Kherson is one of four regions in Ukraine that Moscow annexed in September. Earlier, our correspondent, Johnny Miller, who is covering the war in Ukraine, gave us more details regarding the situation in Kherson. Here he is.
I think it's important to point out that it may be very dangerous for any pro-Russians still left in the city. Russia has made a point of evacuating over recent weeks pro-Russian civilians outside Kherson. They've learned the lessons in what happened in Kharkov a couple of months ago. Where there were reports of pro-Russians being killed by Ukrainian soldiers when they took over the region. I've just watched a very gruesome video of which purports to be Ukrainian soldiers executing a Russian soldier with a hammer. Obviously, there's many Ukrainian soldiers who've lost their lives trying to take back Kherson. The vengeful nature of soldiers on the front line is well documented in warfare. And also there's a huge hatred of Russians now in Ukraine. So there's a fear, and I've seen another video of mistreatment of someone who is said to be a pro-Russian, captured by Ukrainian soldiers in Kherson, being mistreated. So anybody who's said to be or accused of being pro-Russians might be in a very difficult situation in Kherson right now. We also expect many Western media outlets to come into Kherson soon. Ukraine says that they are documenting Russian abuses of power there. So there is a fear also there might be a propaganda campaign in Kherson to stir up more hatred of Russia, which will, of course, promote more war in Ukraine rather than promote both sides going to the negotiating table.
Thousands of Albanians have gathered outside the prime minister's office in the capital, Tirana, to demonstrate against the rising cost of living in the Balkan country. A protest was organized by the opposition Democratic Party of Albania. People gathered in the capital to rally soaring prices and denounce the government's policies. Now, earlier this year, the government had introduced some measures for fiscal relief. However, Albanians don't find it to be enough to alleviate the rising cost of living. Based on national statistics, a third of Albanian citizens are now living below the poverty line, and many complain the high prices are too hard to bear. Costs of food, fuel, and energy have increased amid the Ukraine war. The German capital, Berlin, has witnessed a protest against inflation triggered by soaring prices. During our news review program, we discuss how the future will look for Germany's energy sector. And I welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Okay, we have basically there have been protests throughout the German capital due to the rising cost of living, a crisis, and inflation has soared to 70-year high in Germany. Joining us now for the program is Paul Sheldon Foote, Professor Emeritus of the California State University, Irvine, California, and Mark Thornton, economist, joining us from Alabama. Hello, gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you both to the program now. I guess, Professor Foote, we'll start with you, sir. Your initial thoughts on when you have one of the strongest, if not the strongest, Eurozone economy falling on such tough times. What does that mean for the rest of Europe, and what does that mean going forward?
It's very alarming. The problem in Germany is, with a parliamentary system of government, they have to form coalition governments. Last year, the Green Party got 14.8% of the vote, came in third place. No one had a majority. And so if you are a politician in Germany and you're trying to govern, you have to look around among the minor parties and say, who do I want in my coalition? Do I want to take these climate extremist nuts or someone else? So it's a very rough situation. So Germany politically is very fragile because they have these kind of people in government. And then you've had the blockages recently of the roads. People can't get to work. They can't get to hospitals thanks to these extremists. And 2 years ago, you had the German farmers by the thousands out protesting, saying, you're going to close us down because of your new environmental rules. Well, how can people complain about food prices if they caused it to happen? As long as you keep voting for the Green Party in Germany, you deserve every bit of this.
Thank you, Professor. And Mr. Mark Thornton, welcome to the program. Sir, your initial thoughts on the basically soaring inflation that we're seeing basically worldwide, but how it's impacting Germans and Germany and what that means when you have the strongest, as I mentioned earlier, economy in Europe in tatters like this.
I agree with our other guest that Germany is unstable and climate extremists are really hurting the average person, their pocketbook, their food table, their fuel, everything. And there are a lot of reasons for inflation, but it's not just one country. It's most countries in the world now are experiencing 10% plus inflation, and ultimately that has to go down to what's been happening at central banks. The Federal Reserve has enormously increased the money supply in the United States. The European Central Bank has done even more along with the Bank of Japan. So some of those leading central banks have been emitting enormous amounts of paper money, and prices are going to rise. Now, sometimes they rise in the stock market and everybody's happy, but eventually that money has to be spent. That's what's happening now. It's coming up against shortages or scarcity in terms of grain products, in terms of fuel products, and that's exacerbating. But the basic problem is too much money, and it's driving up the prices of just about everything I see, and it's happening around the world. So the Germans, you know, they may not be hungry today, but they're worried about being hungry tomorrow. They're worried about heating their homes this winter. They're worried about getting cut off from natural gas and not having, because of the German government, not having enough coal-fired energy and the shutdown of their nuclear reactors. And so the government is working against the people, whether it's the legislature or the central banks. They've all been trying to have things the way they want them personally by just printing up money to pay for everything. And, you know, you just can't do that. Eventually, you're going to face higher prices. And when people get hungry or when people are afraid of getting hungry or cold, they're going to go out and protest. And so, you know, a lot of the times people are protesting their governments, but they also need to realize that the central bank, no matter how independent or dependent they are on the government, they're a big, big part of the problem.
Gentlemen, time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Professor Paul Sheldon Foote, Professor Emeritus, joining us from Cal State University, Irvine, California, and Mr. Mark Thornton, their economist, joining us out of sunny Alabama. And that brings us to the conclusion of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Yemen is facing an acute shortage of medical supplies as a Saudi-led coalition is impeding all sorts of imports by continuing its blockade on the country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports out of Sana'a.
The Yemeni Ministry of Health and Population held a press conference in Sana'a to highlight the impact of the continued Saudi siege on the national drug supply program. The event took place amid a severe shortage of necessary medication in the war-torn country.
The Saudi blockade imposed on the national drug supply program has caused one of the world's worst crises in the health sector. Medicines do not arrive on time at all due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport, which has also led to a high rate of death among people with chronic diseases. Patients can't receive basic drugs such as insulin for diabetics, and this is a tragedy no one talks about.
The ministry says almost 169,000 patients cannot receive life-saving medicine and they are in real danger unless the siege is lifted.
The pharmaceutical system in Yemen has been gripped by the Saudi blockade. International companies have partially or completely left the Yemeni market as they face extra costs as well as seizure of vessels for weeks and months. Moreover, medicines should be delivered in special conditions to maintain their quality and effectiveness. The fuel crisis has also negatively affected the shipment of medication.
Earlier, the member of the National Negotiating Delegation, Abdul Malik Al-Ajri, accused Western powers of preventing the entry of medical supplies into Yemen, saying this precedent has never been witnessed throughout history. Officials believe that Saudi Arabia is deliberately preventing medical supplies from entering Yemen to pressure Sana'a to accept the UN agreement as it is. They say the siege has failed throughout 7 years of the war, and the kingdom's measures will push the Yemeni army to carry out new air strikes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin have placed emphasis on deepening political and economic ties. The Kremlin says the two discussed a number of issues over the phone. They stress advancing cooperation in political, trade, and economic fields, including transport and logistics. The phone call came shortly after a senior Russian security official met with Iranian officials in Tehran, where the two countries pledged closer ties. Iran's foreign minister has warned the UN Human Rights Council against attempts to organize a special session on recent riots in Iran. He says if that is to be the case, then Iran's cooperation with the West will be negatively impacted.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian warns of negative consequences if the UNHRC were to go ahead with demands of the West. He criticized the Western double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. In a phone call with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, he said, "Contrary to the UN Charter, few Western countries exploited the peaceful demands in Iran and encouraged violence and offered tutorials on building weapons and Molotov cocktails on media and social networks, which led to the killing of police and insecurity in Iran." He says that if a session is to be held on the riots in Iran, it should in fact probe into foreign government's role in encouraging violence and terror and not on the country that is a true defender of human rights. What Amir Abdullahian is referring to is the piling evidence of actual foreign involvement in the riots, perhaps the most compelling of which was revealed through a joint statement by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and the Ministry of Intelligence. In it, the country's two top intelligence bodies pointed out the major role of foreign intelligence agencies, especially the CIA, in orchestrating the riots. They revealed that they have gone as far as dividing the riots in different stages of pre-unrest, during unrest, and post-unrest. Perhaps the primary way foreign governments, especially the US, UK, and Saudi Arabia, were involved was through supporting foreign Farsi-speaking media that played on people's emotions over a tragic death and capitalized on existing grievances to attempt to overthrow the Islamic establishment through something like a coup d'etat. Iran has warned the UK of consequences for hosting the so-called Iran International Channel, which Iran has recognized as a terrorist organization. Iran also warned Germany for voicing its support for the rioters and calling on the EU to implement more sanctions against Iran.
Human rights has turned into a weapon against countries that are an inconvenience for the West to deal with. Implementing sanctions is the other side of that same coin, and together they form the West policy in dealing with non-conforming nations.
Amir Saeed Iravani, Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations, responded to the U.S. cries of women's rights and human rights being violated in Iran and its calls for a special session to, quote, highlight the ongoing repression of women and girls and members of religious and ethnic minority groups by saying this. The United States lacks the political, moral, and legal qualifications to hold such a meeting, distorting the very basic principles of human rights. He also added, the U.S. has no true and genuine concern about the human rights situation in Iran or elsewhere. Perhaps he was referring to the role that the U.S. has been playing in destabilizing the West Asia region and carrying out terrorist attacks there. Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, and Libya, and its unwavering support for Israeli crimes against Palestinians don't even begin to tell the whole story on U.S.'s destabilizing acts in the region. The U.K.'s involvement in Syria, funding terrorist groups, and being one of the coalition members of the fight against Yemen also nullifies their cries over human rights violations anywhere in the world.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
When speaking about inequality and discrimination, the first country that comes to mind is the United States of America, or, as the situation goes on, the disunited States of America. In just a small example, Forbes this past spring counted up some 2,668 billionaires on its annual list of global private fortunes that run at least 10 digits. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, "Billionaires have become a truly worldwide phenomenon. Forbes this past spring counted up some 2,668 billionaires on its annual list of global private fortunes that run at least 10 digits. And now, the Credit Suisse Research Institute has just published its broader annual census of the world's super rich, an analysis that finds grand mega-million fortunes in nearly every nation. But some nations, the Credit Suisse analysis also shows, host far more of these fortunes than others. And one nation, the United States of America, sits in a wealth class all its own. The United States boasts 39.2% of the world's millionaires. China sits second at 9.9%, with Japan third at 5.4%. The contrast becomes even more striking as we step up even higher into the world of the fabulously wealthy. Some 53% of the global deep pockets worth at least $100 million call the United States of America home. What explains this overwhelming U.S. dominance within the ranks of the world's super rich? The release of another new annual set of stats from the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. points to one prime piece of answer: corporate executive compensation. The Economic Policy Institute has emerged over recent years as America's most perceptive source of CEO pay data. An analyst from the Institute earlier this week released their latest yearly update. The headline stat from this new EPI analysis says corporate chiefs at the 350 top American firms that trade on the stock market last year realized an average $27.8 million in compensation, an 11.1% increase over their previous year's pay, and a record 399 times more than the take-home of typical American workers. Some context can help here. Back in 1965, top U.S. CEOs averaged just 20 times more than the annual compensation of typical American workers. In 1989, a quarter century later, that gap was still only running 59 to 1. The gap since then has multiplied nearly sevenfold. Overall, U.S. CEO compensation has increased 1,460% since 1978, adjusting for inflation. The pay increase for typical U.S. workers over that same time span, just 18%. Rising corporate executive compensation, note EPI's Josh Bivens and Jory Kondra, has fueled the growth of top 1% and top 0.1% incomes, leaving fewer of the gains of economic growth for ordinary workers and widening the gap between the very high earners and the bottom 90%. This increase in U.S. executives' pay has extended far beyond CEO suits. All top corporate officers have feasted in the fabulous windfall. Amazon, for instance, last year generously shared the wealth well beyond the chief executive level. Amazon CEO Andrew Jassy ended the year up $212.7 million. But Amazon's web services chief Adam Selipsy had no reason to complain either. His compensation for the year, $81.4 million. David Clark, Amazon's worldwide consumer chief, enjoyed a lucrative year as well. His pay totaled $56 million. Amazon's most typical warehouse workers, meanwhile, took home $31,705 last year. The pay gap between U.S. corporate excess and workers gives no sign of shrinking anytime soon, and that shouldn't surprise us. Corporate executives sit on each other's boards of directors. These executives have little incentive to rein in CEO pay in hard economic times and every incentive to insist that only continued high executive pay can keep in place the quality leadership that hard times so dramatically demand. Just how much does all U.S. current corporate executive compensation contribute to the wealth of America's wealthiest? Quite a bit. Between 1978 and 2020, the latest year with comparable stats available, the overall inflation-adjusted annual earnings of nation's top 0.1% jumped 385%. CEO compensation during those same years, EPI notes, grew nearly four times as fast. The bottom line, America's distribution of income and wealth will remain ridiculously top-heavy until people start limiting the rewards, continuing to rush and gush into U.S. corporate executive suits. That limit could come in any one of several different forms. Let's start with taxes. In the two decades after the Second World War, individual income over $200,000 faced a federal income tax rate that annually hovered around 90%. The tax pressure served to deflate executive compensation. Why bother scheming for outrageously high executive pay after all, when Uncle Sam stood ready to tax away most of any windfall? Another approach to corporate pay reform, limiting the gap between executive and worker compensation, has been a steadily gaining momentum over the past decade. San Francisco and Oregon's Portland now levy higher tax rates on executive pay that runs over 100 times worker pay. At the state level, legislative proposals along the same line are gaining ground. Nationally, as inequality.org details, progressive lawmakers are working to link federal government contracting and subsidies to CEO worker pay differentials. Their goal, denying federal dollars to corporations with wide pay gaps between executives and workers. Corporate America's continuing failure to limit those gaps plays out dramatically in the latest Credit Suisse Research Institute annual comprehensive stats on national mean and median individual wealth. One example, the United States last year averaged just over $579,000 in wealth per adult, almost double France's $322,000 average. But the most typical, the median French adult held a net worth of just under $140,000, almost $50,000 more than the wealth of the most typical U.S. adult. And on the U.S. rampant inequality and discrimination, Global Times wrote, according to the Native American Rights Fund, Native American voters face 11 common barriers to political participation, including limited government services and a lack of funding for elections. Canada shocked the world with the discovery of alarming numbers of children's remains and unmarked Aboriginal burials at the site of boarding school. The incarceration rate of Indigenous Australian people is 15 times higher than that of non-Indigenous Australians, and the death rate in detention is on the rise, causing family separation and seriously undermining the development of Indigenous communities. What's more, the U.S. systematic discrimination and inequality faced by Indigenous people has not been improved by the implementation of post-pandemic economic and social recovery plans. American Indians and Alaska Natives have long had far higher unemployment rates than other ethnic groups, and the gap has widened during the post-pandemic economic recovery period. According to the recent review conclusions of the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, Indigenous peoples' food security and women's rights are not guaranteed, and the willingness and measures of the United States of America to fulfill its commitment to protection of Indigenous peoples' rights are seriously insufficient. It is noted that the welfare of Indigenous children in the U.S. is still not effectively protected, and violence and crimes against Indigenous women and girls are still rampant, which greatly hinders the recovery of Indigenous communities from the harm caused by the pandemic.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Sister Rehana Kazemi. She has done Bachelor's of Science in Applied Psychology. She's a researcher in the Hafsa Ilmi of Qom, and her research right now is on best trainers and coaches for students in non-Islamic countries with Islamic perspective. A very warm welcome, sister, and assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you very much.
Well, sister, in our previous episodes, we have been talking about the bad habits that the parents told that our children are developing. Then we came back to the upbringing in the ages in the very sensitive time, that is 1 to 7, 7 to 14, and 14 to 21. Then you talked about what were the things that the parents should be taking care in these ages. You said that in first to 7 years, which is supposed to be the age of king, to live like a king or a queen or a prince or a princess, your child, this does not mean that if a child makes a mistake, you can't figure it out. You have to figure out mistakes, but you don't have to punish them as soon in a very early age. Then we discussed in the previous session that 7 to 14 years are the age when you have to treat your child as a slave, but being slave does not mean you have to make him wash clothes, make him clean house or wash dishes. We said you have to make him a responsible person. You have to give him very tiny, tiny jobs that go and clean your room yourself, clean your bedroom yourself, go and take off your uniform yourself, put it in the hanger, put it in the cupboard, and the things like that. Yes. So you actually focus that we have to develop them into responsible beings from 7 to 14.
And also responsible of his bad behavior's consequences. Because everything's in good behavior and in bad behavior. In a result, he needs to understand the consequences, responsibility of consequences. If he does the good things, he will face the good consequences. And if he does the bad thing, definitely he will need to face the bad consequences. That's in that age, if a child can understand the consequences, he will try to avoid the mistakes.
All right. So you're trying to say that we got to tell our child from 7 to 14.
Because he's a slave.
Whatever you're doing, you got to face consequences. Yeah. If you do good things, you will face the consequences.
Yes.
And if you do the bad, you'll face the
because
bad
Because he's
ones.
A slave, and slaves need to understand what I'm doing good and what I'm doing bad. If I'm doing good, I have to get something. I have some good thing for
reward.
Me. He's waiting for me.
He's waiting for the reward, basically. So now in this episode, I would want to ask you about the 14 to 21 years. What about these years? Like, what are the things that parents need to take care of, they need to be very sensitive about?
Every minute of your child is very expensive and a very sensitive and a very delicate for a mother and for a father. Especially in this age when a little child is growing up, he thinks I'm a big man now. Or if a girl, she thinks I'm a big girl now. So they feel themselves a boss, a man of the house. We say in England, you are the man of the house. The child will feel proud that I am the man of the house. So Islam said that's the age when your child is your advisor.
All right. Not at a very early age. So what if a child develops a bossy behavior in a very early age? Like, for example, we had a mother asking, she had a child who was 8 years old, I guess a boy. And we had this question some time ago, and she had been telling us that her child has developed a bossy behavior. They tell the child to turn off the screen or, like, you know, turn off the television. Even they are not authorized, they are not, they can't even tell him to change the channel. So turning off is a very, something very, far away thing. So he has a very bossy behavior from a very early age. What do you say about that?
First of all, the mother or the father needs to figure out what is the reason, why he's behaving like that. Definitely, he had someone in the family who is behaving like this. If a child is like watching TV and his father comes and says, just turn off the TV right now, definitely he will pick up from his father. If the mother does that, definitely he will pick up from the mother. So first thing you need to figure out where he's picking up these things. What is the reason behind this bossy behavior? Maybe there is something that
there's someone in the family behaving like that.
Family behaving, and also there's a lack of something in some children. If he feels that I'm neglected, so definitely the bossy behavior comes in children.
All right. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Sister Rehana Kazemi, and we're discussing the bossy behavior of children. Yes, Sister.
Yes. We were talking about the age of slave.
Yes.
So if you treat the same like you are treating him in the age of 7 to 14, that's not good for his mental health, because your child will not feel good. And after the age of 14 to 21, the children feel that they are the boss of the house. You need to realize them. Yes, you are my advisor. You are a big man of the house. You are the man of the house. After your dad, you are responsible of this whole house. If I am going out, you are responsible of your house work, of your house doings, of your mom. Like Islamically point of view, I will say, when a father is going out, he can say to his child, okay, I am going out. I have to do something, but you are the responsible of this house. You are the responsible of your mother and your sister. You have to do the things. What I was doing, the child feels proud, because this is the age when he wants to feel proud, when he wants to be responsible, when he wants to be a boss of the house. And if you use this quality of the children in a positive way, they will definitely be a responsible man.
All right.
He will definitely turn out a responsible man.
All right. So you're trying to say that in this very sensitive age of 14 to 21, we got to teach our children that we got to give them actually a place, a position
yes.
in the family. We got to tell them, yes, you are someone in the family
yes.
and you are the man of the house or you're the woman of the house. You are the one who is very, very important, who is the one who is going to be taking care of things when the parents are not there.
Yes, because in this age, if he learns the responsibilities, definitely after this age, he will get married and there are so many responsibilities on his shoulder. And if he will never learn these responsibilities in this age, he will be never like a responsible man. So in this age, you need to tell him that you are a responsible person. Do not ignore him or do not press him. Do not impose your decision
or
suppress him. Let him make decision.
All right.
And tell him if you
give him the authority
yes,
of decision making.
Give him authority.
Yeah.
And tell him, first of all, to make any decision, ask your child, what does she think about this? What does she think about that?
Right.
He will feel proud.
Talk to them.
Yeah.
Talk to them. All right.
If you are like buying something, don't say, oh, I like this. I will buy for you.
It seems to be important discussion.
Yes.
We'll discuss more on that after a short
break. He feels his importance.
We'll discuss more on that after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm his sister, Rehana Kazemi, who is telling us about very, very important things that need to be taken care of in the age of 14 to 21 years. So, sister, you're saying, over here, we need to give child a position.
Yes.
We need to give him a status. We need to talk to him. We need to make him a responsible man or a responsible woman. So now you're saying when you want to buy something, do not tell a child that I am buying this thing for you.
Yes.
So you're saying tell him what do you want to buy. Give him a choice. Give him a decision-making authority.
Yes. Do not neglect them in their importance, because these are the small things. When you give them importance in these small things, they will feel their importance. They will feel that I am an important person. If you will neglect them, your child will lose their self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Because in this age, if the child loses the confidence, how he will be like a successful person in future? Because this is the age of making him a something. There's a big future for him. And tell him, you need to make your own decision, but guide him. Tell him, if you are doing this, okay, that's good, but there are the bad effects of this, and there are the good effects of this. There are the bad things. This is the, if you will do this, I'm telling you, both sides, bad and good. No, this is your choice, what you want to choose. Then he will definitely think about that. And when you ask him about his choice and tell him about goods and bads, then he will ask you about your opinion. He will say, I want to choose this, but I want to know what is good in your sight, what you will say. Then you can tell him, yeah, I think that's good. If you are like buying something, you can, oh, that's nice color. That definitely will look nice at you. He will feel proud. He will feel his authority, he will feel his importance, and he will be more confident to make his decisions.
All right. So I would want to ask you a very small question about girls over here. The girls who are being ignored, especially in the Asian countries in this age, what do you think, what will they develop into? Don't you think they try to find out this love, this authority somewhere outside in the society?
I will think there's a drawback in their training. Maybe parents neglect them in their early childhood. Or maybe they do not treat them equally like the, because in the Asian.
The boys are treated, yes. Yeah. So since we talked about Asian countries, so yeah. It is very important issue that
yeah.
girls are not treated
equally like boys.
Yeah.
So there is definitely some drawback. There is something going on in their like.
Are you trying to say that in Islam we don't have any difference yeah. in a boy
always
or a girl?
Always treat equally the boys and the girls.
All right.
So there's a big mistake which parents, definitely I will say, especially in the Asian countries, they do not treat equal. They always say, "Oh, you are girl. He's boy. He's the man of the house. He has authority." And in this
you
way,
are a girl, you got you yeah. don't have you don't have got you have got nothing to do yeah. with all this. All right. Thank you so much, sister, for being with us. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, dear audiences, comments or suggestions, please contact us on englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on the social media websites just by searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also listen to our programs on our official website, that's www.parstoday.com. Until another program, fi aman Allah, and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States is not what you see in the flamboyant Hollywood movies. Normal life in the U.S. might surprise you, as the number of people without a stable place to call home has increased by at least 22,500 over the past 3 years to 173,800 since the pandemic. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites. Stay tuned, please. The Hill wrote, "The typical American experiencing homelessness is often conceived of a mentally ill individual living in the subways of New York or an addict on the streets of San Francisco or Philadelphia. Those conceptions capture some of the crisis of homelessness, but not all of it. Among the 550,000 to 600,000 people experiencing homelessness in the U.S. are tens of thousands who are not chronically homeless. nor incapacitated due to illness or substance use disorder. These people are capable of work and ready to integrate into the mainstream job market. They are frequently overlooked in the debate on how we solve homelessness and also in publicly funded policy solutions. Works Fund combines paid work in social enterprise with transitional housing and support services for people not currently eligible for housing first resources yet who are not self-resolving off the streets or out of shelters. Work programs act as a bridge for marginalized homeless populations with the capacity and desire to work to re-enter the workforce and obtain permanent housing. Tens of thousands of Americans fit that description. Solutions like work benefit not only their target population, but also the larger community through earnings, cost savings, increased labor hours, and more available housing. The three-pronged approach of the work model provides primary and secondary benefits, while its philosophy and implementation design allow for community integration and buy-in in a way that other strategies cannot. There has never been more urgency for employment-based solutions because of the ongoing labor shortage. The roughly 11 million jobs now unfilled represent a historic opportunity to increase employment among the homeless population. Employers are struggling to find workers, while over 70% of people experiencing homelessness are unemployed. And even those who are technically working are really underemployed. With more public support, work programs can develop relationships between local employers and municipal governments. Hill continued, homelessness is a symptom of many systematic failures of policy and practice in housing, behavioral health, workforce development, and the criminal justice system. There is no one-size-fits-all solution. It's past time to encourage innovation to develop programs that take into account the diversity of needs of people experiencing homelessness and promote the belief that those on the streets can and should be seen as assets to the community, as contributing members of society. Today, with homelessness on the rise in the U.S., U.S. citizens are perplexed by the lack of success their communities are having to adequately address this crisis. Also, Politico wrote, rising homelessness is tearing California cities apart. A crew of state workers arrived early one hot summer day to clear dozens of people camped under a dusty overpass near California's capital. The camp's residents gathered their tents, coolers, and furniture and shifted less than 100 feet across the street to city-owned land where they have been ever since. But maybe not for much longer. The city of Sacramento is taking a harder line on homeless encampments and is expected to start enforcing a new ban on public camping by the end of the month, if the courts allow. Also, Times of San Diego wrote, the first statewide snapshot of California's homelessness crisis since the pandemic hit reveals that the number of people without a stable place to call home increased by at least 22,500 over the past 3 years to 173,800. That's based on a Call Masters analysis of the federal government's point-in-time count a biennial head count of people sleeping on the streets and in shelters tallied in by California cities and counties earlier this year for the first time since 2019. Homelessness experts mostly attribute the rise to precipitous drops in earnings during the pandemic among Californians already teetering on the edge. They also point to a worsening housing affordability crisis that is decades in the making. We have to solve this rotting core in the center of California, which is that we are a million units short of housing for exemplary low-income workers, said Margot Cochelle, director of the UCSF Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative. While homelessness grew by 15%, roughly the same space as in recent years, something experts credit to pandemic-era safety nets like rental assistance, eviction moratoria, and stimulus checks. The data also indicates the problem has gotten worse for the state's Latino population. Critics are quick to point out the state is spending more than $14 billion on homelessness, but advocates say its response is just now beginning. The price tag is bigger now, said Tomika Moss, founder and chief executive of All Home, a San Francisco-based homeless policy organization, saying, "Meanwhile, the inflow is killing us." The numbers show the state's investment in shelters is bearing fruit. California created more than 14,000 shelter beds between 2019 and 2021. And local organizations reported this year the number of people staying in emergency and longer stay shelters ballooned by nearly the same amount, from 42,800 to 57,200 people, a 33% increase since 2019. Christopher Ware, president of the Center for Homeless Inquiry, said, "Most people, most politicians, when they talk about homelessness, it's we're going to build X number of shelters. It's shelter, shelter, shelter. Well, all of this construction of shelters doesn't really change the scope of the problem. Meanwhile, the unsheltered count or the number of people staying in tents, tarps, cars, and other spaces unfit for human habitation grew by 7% between 2019 and 2022 to 116,600 people. That's a bomb, but perhaps not reflective of the growing palpability of the crisis that dominates local headlines, political debates, and neighborhood discussions."
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.